folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCRIT Podcast. Alrighty, folks. So, Nixon, you know, Chris, the Thumper Nixon, came and visited me in New York City and told me no more airway topics. Come on, man, there's more to ED critical care than just airway, and he's right. But I had a few in the pipeline already that I do need to put out. They're just too good not to put out there, so I have to get them out. But then, for a while, no more airway, because that's what Mr. Nixon told me. But today, I have Dan Davis from San Diego on, and Dan is an ED doc and a pre-hospital doctor, and he does a lot of resuscitation training and research, and I figured I'd talk to him today about two topics of particular interest to me. If you've ever heard me give the laryngoscope as a murder weapon talk, you know that I'm very interested in these two topics, and those two topics are the pulse ox lag, or what he calls pulse ox latency, and then at which point during an intubation do you look up at the pulse oximetry on the monitor and say, enough's enough, we got to reoxygenate before we go any further. But let's get right to Dr. Davis.
My name is Daniel Davis. I'm an emergency physician at the University of California in San Diego. Spend most of my time doing research, quite a bit of time doing training and resuscitation, and then provide medical direction both for the hospital with regard to resuscitation, as well as for our air medical services here in Southern California.
Fantastic. And you've done extensive work in pre-hospital resuscitation with a particular interest in airway and ventilatory management. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. So I think the first topic that is of particular interest to me, and it's been something we've been talking about on the podcast for a while now, is the idea of pulse oximetry lag, or as you call it in your articles, latency. Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't know that it's been widely disseminated. At least it was news to me, and in fact, it was a clinical case in our trauma suite that first brought it to my attention when a patient who had a broken leg was being intubated to facilitate his trip to the operating room. And we noted that once we realized that the initial attempts at intubation were going to be unsuccessful and we needed to bag him back up, that he didn't seem to be responding to bag valve mask ventilation. And we quickly got into a clinical conundrum in that the FATs were dropping through the high 80s into the mid 80s into the low 80s and had to make a decision as to whether we should pull out and make a frantic attempt at intubation or whether we should hang in there. And I remember thinking at the time that the best evidence I had available to me that we were better off staying put and continuing to bag valve mask ventilate was that his chest was going up and down, and as long as the bag valve mask was plugged into oxygen, there was nothing that intubation was going to provide that we weren't already providing, but we might end up going through another 20, 30 seconds or longer of laryngoscopy without ventilation. But afterwards, I thought, you know, what was this? Why did this guy with otherwise normal lungs take such a long time to reoxygenate? And I stumbled into a literature that was mostly in the medical technology section of our body of knowledge, not really in the clinical section, but it documented very nicely that when a pulse oximetry probe is placed on a digit, on a finger, there is a predictable lag from what's happening centrally to what's reflected or picked up peripherally. And that it's as simple as the blood being in the finger, not having been in the central circulation for anywhere from 20 or 30 seconds in a normally perfused, normal room temperature individual, all the way out to, and we found in our air medical environment where it's often cold and the patients are often in shock, out to up to 3 minutes, that things that are happening centrally are being reflected finally in the peripheral pulse oximetry probe.
Now, if we put this in real clinical terms, it means, just as you say, you could be doing everything perfectly with your reoxygenation attempts, and the patient will continue to look worse by pulse oximetry, and that could lead to some bad things. In fact, you just published a couple of case reports on people actually pulling tubes in the pre-hospital environment as a result of pulse ox lag. You want to talk about that for a second?
Well, absolutely. There's a number of ways that it can affect your decision-making. First of all, if the goal is to pull out from an intubation attempt before the patient becomes hypoxic, and yet you're looking in a rearview mirror from anywhere from 30 seconds out to 2 or 3 minutes, then you never really get enough time or enough warning to know when the patient's hypoxic, that you really don't get to see whether they were hypoxic when you made the decision to pull out for another couple of minutes. So as far as real-time decision-making, you really can't base it on a pulse oximeter. And unfortunately, the sicker the patient, the longer the latent period, and those are the ones who arguably can tolerate the hypoxemia less. There's a very tangible black-white decision, like I described in our case, where we either had to stop bagging and try another attempt or hang in there and continue bagging. But for many people who learn the axiom, when in doubt, pull it out, so anything that suggests there's something not right about the tube, go ahead and pull it, that can lead to the removal of a tube that was actually in the right place. And the cases that we described were concurrent with the introduction of end-tidal CO2 monitoring into the field. So this was back a few years ago. So at that time, people weren't really as convinced that the end-tidal CO2 was the end-all be-all for tube confirmation. And again, if in the face of a falling pulse oximetry tracing, the safe thing to do was pull out and go back to bag valve mass ventilation. So that's what we have described in this paper. For our crews, there are some other issues that come up, and that's, you know, when do you say that the SAT is high enough and that you can go back to a second attempt, or if it's prior to the first attempt, when do you say that your SAT has peaked and that it's okay to go ahead and make your first attempt? And then in the hospital, we're realizing that sleep apnea, often facilitated by drugs and anesthetics, is a large contributor to mortality and morbidity, and that knowing in real time that some of these pulse oximetry values is dropping or that they're hypoxic, knowing it 2 or 3 minutes ahead of time may make the difference between coming in and finding a hypoxic patient who can be stimulated and given supplemental oxygen and recovered, versus somebody who's already in PEA arrest and requires chest compressions.
Sure. So let's talk about some better strategies than necessarily yanking the tube. Now, the first one you mentioned in your article is that every single tube, whether it's pre-hospital or in hospital, should really be with quantitative waveform CO2 monitoring. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I don't think there's anywhere where you can use the excuse that some form of quantitative capnometry is a standard of care. I think there are places that would argue that the semi-quantitative colorimetric device is an acceptable alternative, but some form of capnometry for sure.
Well, I would argue that the colorimetrics no longer cut it. I mean, it might be fine for initial confirmation until you get your quantitative set up, but I think in this day and age, after NAP4, there's just no excuse not to do exactly what would be happening in the operating room, which is continuous quantitative waveform monitoring. And that would be one way to avoid yanking a tube as the pulse ox is dropping, is look up at the monitor, see the waveform. The last thing I want to talk about on this topic is, have you looked at central oximetry as a way of decreasing this latency?
Well, absolutely. And this is probably where I should declare a conflict of interest. In fact, in response to our initial observations in the air medical environment, I actually went to one of the device manufacturers and asked them to make a probe that measured centrally. I had stumbled upon a picture of somebody's ear in the cold weather. It was actually an earmuff commercial of all things, and I have no idea why I happened to stumble upon that, because we don't tend to use a lot of earmuffs here in San Diego. But nevertheless, it struck me that the inside of the ear, kind of behind the tragus, into the what's called the concha of the ear, that looks kind of like a cave, but not quite into the canal. That concha stays well perfused, and it turns out it's got duplicitous blood supply, even potentially some from the internal carotid, but certainly duplicitous blood supply from the external carotid. And so even in a low flow state, whether it's because of temperature or because of some shock situation, you tend to get good blood flow there. And so I just sort of offered it up as an idea. They recommended that I go back to my intellectual properties office and patent the idea, which I was a little bit loath to do because it sounded like a lot of work in dealing with lawyers. But eventually, to get it done, did do that. The university now has the patent, and we've been testing the early prototypes, and there appears to be quite a bit of promise. You can probably approximate that by taking a sticky finger probe, and if you can line up the sensor portion and the emitter portion together, achieve some measure of the same thing. But that's one option, is measuring at the ear and not just the ear lobe, but inside the ear itself. There are forehead probes available, and we had tried those in the pre-hospital environment and found that it seemed that every patient had either a hematoma, a laceration, or a big piece of white tape across their forehead. So we didn't find that as useful, but I think in the emergency department, that may give us a viable option, and that that's another spot that's well perfused, and that latent period becomes much, much shorter. There's probes that can go on the nose itself, or you can even take a finger clip and stick it in the buccal surface as well, but then you tend to interfere with some of the back valve mask and other airway maneuvers, and so I think that's a little less useful for resuscitation world.
Absolutely. All right, so we're looking forward to that probe coming out that we'll just clip on around the tragus. Now, the second topic I wanted to talk to you about is the optimal bailout point during airway management. And by what I mean, I mean by that is, at what point do you give up an intubation attempt and say we have to reoxygenate this patient before we go any further? The classic teaching is that that sharp slope of the oxy disassociation curve is at around 90%, but you actually put it higher from your research. Can you talk about that?
Well, the point where the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve goes from horizontal to vertical is around 93%, and the use of 90% is only historical from the trauma literature that we had to choose something, and it seemed, given our fascination with a decimal system, to choose something that was 10 points less than perfect, and 90 has kind of stuck from that point forward. But if you really look at the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, the inflection point's a bit higher, and particularly given the latent period, it would make sense to pull out a little bit sooner. Now, to some degree, there's a party pooper effect. You don't want to have to pull out any sooner than you have to, particularly if you're in training. You want to hang in there, and the typical stall tactic is to ask for suction. And that way, at least you have sort of an excuse. Nobody really knows if you need it or not. And I teach our attendings to be very suspicious when somebody asks for suction, but nothing comes out when they stick it in the mouth. That's a little bit of spit because it's probably somebody who's having trouble visualizing. But we used a slightly higher point. And saying 93, I figure that people were probably pulling out now at 90. When before, when we said 90, they're probably pulling out at 85 or 80. So it's there's a little bit of a lag or a latent thing just in the way that you teach and what they actually do. But all of that being said, to some degree, we've had to return to a very old-school approach, not unlike the take a deep breath, don't you need to breathe, the patient needs to breathe, but not quite that generic. Instead, what we've done is teach based on the shape of a curve that we defined using pre-hospital data, and it's been published, that I initially thought was novel information and then realized it's just the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. But we displayed it kind of as a mirror image. But it gives you a sense of how much time you have with particular SAT values, and you have up to 5 or 6 minutes before you're going to reach the 93% threshold if you can achieve oxygen saturation values in the 99 to 100% range, as opposed to only 20 or 30 seconds if you can only get the SATs up to 94. And so it's a little more, it takes a little more thought at the time, but before you start an attempt, we teach our crews and we teach our residents and attendings to estimate in your mind how much time you think you have. and that if you, for instance, have somebody with a SAT of 93, 94%, and you've exceeded 20 or 30 seconds, even though you may not see the change on the pulse oximeter, you need to pull out and start to bag up, and then wait 30, 60 seconds, you'll see the desaturation, and you'll see the dip in oxygen saturation occur. And until we get better SAT probes, or at least better locations for SAT probes, we're stuck with that latent period and always looking in our rearview mirror.
That's an amazing, amazing point. So this is not only the bailout point, but you're actually saying if for some reason you can't get a patient up to the optimal saturation, you get in there, you get one shot at it, and then you get out and reoxygenate, even if the pulse ox hasn't dropped yet, because you know physiologically they're going to drop. You just not see it for another 60 to 90 seconds.
Absolutely, and that becomes even more critical when you're dealing with a patient who you could never get into the 90s. So say you have a patient with a SAT of 85%, you're sitting on the vertical portion of the curve, and so we actually show a picture of El Capitan, a famous mountain in Yosemite Valley, and have them imagine what would happen if you were clinging to the side of El Capitan and then let go, that you're not going to hover in space, and that perception that when you start an attempt with a SAT of 85% and the SAT's not budging, that's the latent period, and you're going to see it fall. It may not be until after the tube goes in or until well into your attempt, but rest assured that it's falling and that you need to tell yourself going into that sort of an attempt with such a low SAT value at baseline that you really only have about 10 seconds and you need to pull out even if you don't see the values change at all. And again, hopefully that will change once we get some of these new SAT probes, or at least the new locations.
Excellent. All right. Well, I know you have to get back to the inmates,
yep.
But thank
back
you so much for your time.
And their cups against their bars. We want Vicodin.
Oh, my gosh.
At any rate.
All right, folks. Maybe you have not had enough Dan Davis. Go to the show notes, which are at mcrit.org, and click on this episode, and you will find a YouTube video which is just hysterical on how to kill a patient with the BVM during cardiac arrest. It is Dan Davis in a way you could never imagine an academic emergency physician actually representing himself. It is good stuff. So let's review what we talked about today. Two concepts. One, pulse ox lag or latency. In a normal patient, what you see on the pulse ox 30 to 60 seconds in the past, on a sick patient up until 3 minutes in the past is what you're seeing when you look up at that pulse ox. How do you fix this? Well, maybe central will take precedence later on in the future. But for now, you need to have quantitative waveform and tidal. And if that is on the BVM, then regardless of what the pulse ox is reading, if you see waveforms, you know the breaths are going in. It needs to be there when you confirm a tube, because if you see waveforms and the pulse ox is still dropping, you know what's going on. It's pulse ox lag. You see end tidal waveforms. Or it needs to be put on your BVM between the mask and the bag so that for every breath you give, you know that you are getting ventilations in, and if the pulse ox is not coming up yet, you know you're doing the best you can. If you are getting 10 to 12 end tidal waveforms that are lasting a significant period of time, that patient will reoxygenate, and if they're not reoxygenating, there's nothing you could do better with that BVM. They need a PEEP valve, or they need their pneumothorax relieved, or something else horrible is going on. I think we could leave it there. All of Dr. Davis's articles we talked about in the show are at the show notes, mcrit.org. I will say, if you are listening to this and you are not a member of the MCRIT CME program, well, that's just crazy. It's a big waste. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast, saying.